In George Orwell's Animal Farm, we hear Napoleon the Pig proclaim, "All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others." Today we pause to ask, where can we find the animals that are most equal of all?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1,200th edition of the Food Chain Radio, or perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Fremantle who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, pork, that other white meat, feeds more humans throughout the world than any other meat. One reason pigs feed so many people is that people have figured out how to grow and process them on an industrial scale in concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. One reason pigs feed so many people is that in a CAFO, you can grow as many as 150,000 pigs a year in metal cages, so small that the pigs can't turn around, and so spend their lives facing in one direction. The cages are suspended above waste pits that are ventilated with big electric fans that push the ammonia and hydrogen sulfide gases out into the neighborhood. To prevent infections, the pigs are fed a daily regime of antibiotics to keep them alive for the 6 months, at which time they would be processed into food. Now, I'm not going to hang around here and disparage a technology that produces 97% of the nation's pork, but I'm going to reintroduce a way of growing pigs that just might be more equal and more appetizing. And so right now we're going to head out to Hollister, California to meet Jack and Sarah Kimmick. They, the proprietors of California Kuro Buddha Pasture Raised Pork. Welcome to the Food Chain, Jack.
Good morning. Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you. And Sarah, welcome aboard.
Oh, all right.
So we have Jack and Sarah. Now, you two have been partners and husband and wives in the pig business for how long?
Since 2010.
2010, almost a decade in the pig business. Jack, how the
heck? Oh my gosh, has it been that long?
Jack, how did you get? How did you bring your family into the business of pasture-raised pork?
Well, it's actually my youngest daughter, Katie, who came up with the idea. I had injured my back and was out of work for 2 years, and so while we were recuperating, we were trying to come up with another form of income, and we have a ranch in Hollister and organic, and we thought, well, let's look at something else. And my daughter said, let's look at pigs. So we researched, found Berkshires being the premium table meat, and we spent about a year contacting chefs and meat cutters and food aficionados, and we ended up finding two pregnant gilts. And a gilt is a female pig that has never had piglets before. And so we started our herd with two pregnant gilts. And within 30 days, we had 22 pigs.
Sarah, all of a sudden you have 22 piglets.
Yes, quite a surprise.
Now,
pigs have large litters. And you were talking about how they feed so many people worldwide. Part of the reason is pigs are omnivores, which makes them easier to feed because they can eat such a wide range of foods. And that's kind of the secret to our success. We thought we'd come up with something very original. Our pigs are on pasture, and we supplement their pasture with seasonal fruits and vegetables and nuts and recycled grains from our local area. And we found several years ago, we got a call from the Japanese Ministry of Agriculture, and in the conversation with them, we found that we were using something that they've been doing for a long time called Japanese traditional farming. And that's the method that we use to feed our pigs. And it's very different from what you described in the beginning. It's completely different.
Well, and that's why I said, you know, reintroduce perhaps a more equal and certainly more appetizing way of growing pigs. It's because if you look back at human history, the pigs have been with us for 10,000 years. I mean, they were really one of the means by which we stopped being hunters and gatherers. And so they've been with us all that time. And how we developed that incredible relationship was really aptly described by Sarah in that they're omnivores and they could eat anything. And so we can take them all over the world with us and they can feed us that way. And the other element was described by Jack, and that's the litter size, Jack?
Yes. Yeah, because they're out on pasture, we don't restrict any breeding. Our boars, they run around and do their job whenever it feels the time is right. So we have litters, piglets being hatched out every month. But the benefit there is in the hot season, they'll have a smaller litter. And when it's really ideal weather, they'll have the large litters of 12 and 14. And then when it's cold, we have huge piles of compost that they burrow into. And so they've never used their huts that we had for them. So they just burrow into the compost and they make these beautiful nests, and the compost is 120 degrees. Sure. So everybody stays comfortable, and we have probably about a medium-sized litter in the wintertime.
So what we're describing here is just about exactly the opposite of the CAFO.
Yeah, oh, yes. And one of the cruelest things about the CAFO is that pigs are very intelligent, and for them to be confined in that way is like someone being in jail in a very small cage.
It's almost exactly, almost exactly like being in jail.
It is, and it's almost as cruel as it would be for a person because pigs are so intelligent. And that's another thing that we found out kind of the hard way because we were ignorant. That's why pigs are seldom raised on pasture like we do, because they are hard to confine. They are able to push, jump, and burrow under fences. They, dig under with their noses. And so they are, if they want to get out, they can be very determined and hard to stop.
So then you have to make sure that the grass is greener on your side of the fence.
Yes.
Exactly.
That's the method we mainly use. We have good fences, and they're augmented with an electric fence, but that doesn't work 100% of the time. And we had a really different experience when we got flooded in 2017, and it washed away quite a bit of our interior fencing and some of our perimeter fencing too. And all our neighbors were very, very gracious about, we had some pigs running around, and it took a while to get them all back in. And everyone in our area was so kind and cooperative about that. They could have been,
including
mean. Well, we had one female pregnant sow escaped and went to a neighbor's front yard and created a nest in their front yard, which required removing every shrub that they had. And they were very, very gracious about the whole thing.
Wow.
So,
Before we go on, I'd like to ask about you have a family farm, a real family farm now, in that this whole enterprise was started by your daughter. How old was she when she came up with this idea?
Let's see, she was about 12.
And how many other kids do you have?
We have two other kids, and in one way or another, they've all been involved also. And, because they're our offspring, they have no problem having input into what we do. And
whether we want it or not.
Whether you want it or not, yeah.
No, our oldest daughter was instrumental in helping us set up the way we sell the pigs, and she ran the website for us until quite recently, till late last fall, when in December she gave birth to twins.
Ah.
And so at that point, she handed the reins of the website over to me, which has not been a great thing. And our son has helped us. We quickly figured out, when you have a new business, you try a lot of different venues and see what works for you and what you can handle. And we figured out rather quickly that we couldn't raise the pigs and market them and do any kind of catering of the pork in addition. And so our son took over doing that, and he's catered several very, very nice events. And, you know, he'll do it any time now. He works full-time, so...
And when you say cater, what you mean is that he takes a whole hog out there and barbecues it, right?
Yes, and he does a fantastic job. He enjoys it, and he's really, really good at it. So he does that for us now because it's just a little too much on top of all the other things we do.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this. Did you ever have to teach your kids about the birds and the bees when you have a whole herd of pigs in the pasture?
Now we've had to teach other kids about the birds and the bees, visitors. Yeah, it's rather evident when the birds and the bees haven't been taught to other people's kids. And so they come out to the farm to play, and suddenly...
You're in the middle of an explanation that probably you weren't planning on having, right?
Yes. We're prepared for it. So.
And one more quickie
it's
before...
pretty natural.
Yeah, and one more quickie before we go on. Wild pigs. Hollister is in an area of California that has a lot of wild pigs. Do yours and theirs ever meet?
You know, we're very fortunate. We have two major thoroughfares on either side of our farm, and we have a lot of really well-fenced farms between us. So as of yet, knock on wood, our pigs are on about 30 acres, and we have yet to have any encroachment of wild pigs.
So when you say thoroughfare, is that a wild pig thoroughfare?
Well, no, it's roadways. It's highway, major highways. And because of the residential areas and the farm, there's always a lot of cross fencing that before the pigs would... We've seen them dead on the highway, but we've never seen them down here at our place. So knock on wood, we're
in the middle of a little valley, and on the north side is a range of hills, and the pigs are up there. And it's all pretty wild territory, and some of it is state park. And on the other side is towards the town of Hollister. We're about 7 to 10 miles away from Hollister. And so between us, there's a lot of fenced agricultural land. So we're pretty well protected from the intrusion by wild pigs.
Do you see a marked difference in behavior of the two, of the wild and the tame pigs?
You know, I've got buddies that have, you know, gone hunting and picked up some piglet, and then they've raised them as domestic pigs, and they said that, you know, they'd walk out there and they'd run up to them and want treats and stuff. So I believe that they're probably, they could revert back to being feral or back to wild environments, you know, to protect themselves. We have coyotes that come over, and I can tell when the coyotes have pestered the sows. Because when our dogs go amongst
Can you hold that thought? We have to take a quick break. Folks, we'll be right back with Jack and Sarah Kimmick, California Kuroboto, pasture raised pigs, and you.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we were talking a little bit about what happens when the coyotes come to visit the pig farm. Jack, can you continue that story? Because that's always an interesting conflict.
Because we do a natural process out here. The coyotes, when they come in, we try to, you know, chase them off, and we have other dogs that try to go after them and chase them. But the pigs are very adept at protecting themselves, and the sows are fearless. When the coyotes have been pestering the sows, we could tell, because our dogs will run amongst them like they normally do, and then the sows actually alert to the dog. And pigs have very poor eyesight. And so they rely on their ears to be able to hear things and then their sense of smell. And we were told that the pigs have like 500 times the sensory ability of dogs.
Wow.
And so in the nose, smelling department. So they're very capable of protecting themselves. So far we've had coyotes come in, and we've seen, you know, a couple piglets that got attacked and hauled off. But in general, we're very fortunate with our fencing and and whatnot.
Take us back to the start of your pasture-raised pig farm. How on earth did you start that process? Because what you're doing is really trying to emulate pigs in nature, but in a confined space. So where did you start?
Well, we bought those two sows, and they had their babies, and we allowed them free reign. And originally our intent was to rotate them from pasture to pasture. And really how we got started doing their food the way that we do now is they had a drought in the Midwest. So that meant the price of corn kept escalating, and the cost of the pig food we were buying at the feed store kept going up and up with no end in sight. And meanwhile, our herd was multiplying, and we realized this is just going to become unaffordable. So we already had a trucking company, and so we used the trucking company that was already in place to haul cold vegetables, leftovers, overages. And there we found that there are a lot of products that are thrown away, agricultural products, that people are eager to get rid of and will be glad to give you for free. And it saves costs for them. So that's how we got started on that. It really was because of the drought in the Midwest.
And there's all of a great source of food because you're in an agricultural district in California that produces a lot of surplus plant material.
Our fence that separates us from an organic farm is a perfect example. Sometimes they just put a bin on our side of the fence.
Wow. Happy pigs. I understand that pigs have the intelligence of a three-year-old, but are as wily as a coyote, which means that how on earth did you learn to control, or do you even control them?
Well, there's a couple things that work in our favor, and one of them is we have a very hot electric fence. And so once the pigs are trained to see those wires, they will not push against the fence. Now, if you have a regular fence, like a twisted wire fence, they will push against that until they've either uprooted it or pushed it over. They're like, 200-pound bulldozers or gophers. And so the hot wire, we have three wires, and it will contain the pigs within their necessary place. The other thing that they deal with is food. They love food. And so because we were able to haul the large volumes of cold vegetables, we let them free choice feed 24/7. And so if we need to do work in one pasture, then what we do is we'll take that food and we'll drop it in another area. And then the pigs will go to that area. They all migrate over. And then we're able to tend to the fields and replant and sow new seed and then fence it off. So it's a lot of work, but they love their food. And every once in a while, we'll get treats. We'll have some company call us and say, hey, I got a pallet of cantaloupes. Can you come pick them up? And so we'll go out there and hand feed cantaloupes to the pigs. So they know our voice. They know that we bring them good things. So when they hear the tractor start up, they'll come running because they know that tractor's carrying a ton of food for them. We used to haul distillery grains from Lost Spirits Distillery when they started in Castroville. And so they made a whiskey or a scotch, basically, and the oatmeal waste products that they had went into a tanker. Well, the first time we put it in our 400-gallon trough, the pigs loved it, and it was a marvelous product for them. They just loved it. So from then on, when that truck drove down the driveway, I'd have 100 pigs chasing it, squealing in delight because they're going to get their booze.
When you learn how to manage them out in the pasture, I understand that the more time you spend with them, the more domesticated they become. As you said, when you're out there with them, feeding them good things, then you can kind of walk among them be safe. But if you don't tend to them, and if you don't develop that relationship, not so safe. Is that true?
Absolutely. And when we first got the pigs, Jack was not as familiar as I was with how protective mother animals are in general when they give birth. And, for the first day or two, they might still be a little gentle. And Jack had really made friends with those first two sows in particular they would practically sit on his lap. He'd feed them little treats and apples and pork rinds, things like that. And they love them. And so when the first sow gave birth, he kind of assumed that his relationship with the sows would be the same. They'd just be babies. And so he picked up one of the babies and walked away a little bit with it to look at its ears, because we were going to notch their ears to identify them. And the piglet was fine, and then suddenly it just started squealing, and all of a sudden the mother was in attack mode, and she rushed Jack, she knocked him over and started savaging him. Meanwhile, he'd thrown the piglet back towards her, but that didn't stop her. She was really, really angry, and she pushed him around through the forest of trees at the time and kept savaging and biting him until she felt like, okay, everything's okay now. Then she ran back to where all the piglets were and laid down. Everything was fine. He was a little surprised.
And did Jack learn his lesson?
He did.
Yes. I was laughing because it was the funniest thing. I had never seen something like that. And so that afternoon, I was over there feeding her apples, and everything was fine. But something that herds people have to do, when you're dealing with animals, you have to be able to read the animals. Our first boar was hand-raised, and so he was very friendly, and he'd come up, and he's got, you know, sharp tusks and stuff, and you had to be careful because he'd swing his head against you to try to get you to scratch him. And so you just can't interrupt a boar. Like, if there's a sow in heat, you stay away because you just don't want to get in between that. And those tusks will cut you open.
Well, they get pretty competitive, don't they, the boys? You know, that leads me to a question. You two have been raising pasture-raised pigs for a decade. As you watch them grow and matriculate, do you ever compare them with people?
Oh, yes, of course. There are many, many similarities. And the development of a piglet from birth to maturity is quite similar to a child. Pigs are very strong animals, too. You know, we've probably all seen in person or seen a movie of a foal being born, and it struggles to its feet, and it wobbles around, and after a few hours it's able to nurse. And piglets are born walking, and they're amazingly sturdy the minute they come out of the womb. And we have found piglets almost a quarter mile away from their mother, who's still there giving birth to the rest of the litter, and the little piglet's wandering away, trailing his umbilical cord.
Wow.
And so we've had some fun adoptions, because they're easy to get back together. When the mother is giving birth, she's pretty quiet. She's not in attack mode at that point because she's busy. And so you can approach them. And Jack has a special way of bringing back piglets to their mother, or even adopting them to another mother who has newborns.
Jack?
And I'll let him explain that.
Yeah, Jack?
Yeah, we, every once in a while something happens. We have to do, you know, like a little piglet gets a cut on it or something. So we do a real quick vet check and to bring them back into the nursing mother, what we do is I have a little bottle with vanilla extract, and I poke a little hole in the top of it, and it makes like a squirt gun. So I squirt the mom and the other piglets with the vanilla extract, and then I squirt the the one that's being brought into the fold, I squirt him with the vanilla extract. And then at nighttime, or when she's nursing or quiet, and I can very carefully sneak up there and put a foreign piglet in with them, and she sniffs them all and goes, "Hey, you must be mine." And then they go. But pigs are very community-wise. I've had three sows all giving birth at about the same time, all in the same area, you know, within 10 feet of each other. And so the male sleeps outside and the females are all together, and the piglets, they grow so fast that way because they nurse from one mom and then they go to the next mom and they just make the rounds nursing. And so they're very community. And I've had a sow whose sister would try to take the babies and try to nurse the babies and you know, act all motherly. So it's a very interesting community you know, mm-hmm. with the pigs and the other offspring. But we don't worry about, like, we have boars that come in, and you'll look and you'll see the mom is gone, and there's, you know, there's a boar laying down with piglets piled all over it. And it's not what you hear about in the media and whatnot about how dangerous boars are and all this other stuff. A pretty neat community.
Well, that takes us to the essential difference then between animals that are confined in those CAFOs and animals like yours that are raised outside. When the animals are confined, having a boar is really problematic because, you know, they start smelling rank and they start upsetting all the other pigs in the next pen and all kinds of hell break loose. But when they're turned loose, it's a different behavior, right?
It's totally different. The I've had people that raise pigs in pens and stuff talk to me, and you hear their stories, and it's like, oh my gosh, I would never try to move a boar into another group of you know, sows. It's just very dangerous at that time. So for us, we look around, and I've got I have three breeding boars, and we update the bloodlines and let them, you know, do their job. And you know, they'll walk past each other and they'll, you know, knock heads a little bit, and every once in a while the bigger one will try to push the littler one around, and or a littler one will come try to challenge the bigger one. But you know, pigs are really tough animals. Mm-hmm. And they tussle for a little bit, then they walk away. And it's not uncommon to see you know, a group of piglets stay, or of pigs in general, staying with one boar. And the other boar doesn't come in there, they'll stay away from them, you know. So they sort of have their own little community.
So they don't really fight it out for dominance in the herd then. You have, and
no,
all of these critters are loose in the pasture, so there's no male or there's no man or person out there telling pigs what to do.
Right. They kind of naturally tend to have areas, and the way the property is divided by a waterway and grove of trees, and they have three distinctly separate areas. And they tend to have a herd that mostly stays in its area.
You have pigs running around in how many acres? 30 acres?
About 30 acres.
Yeah.
Don't they wear it out?
You know, well, we've had some problems with that since the flooding that removed so much of our fencing. We had a lot of cross fencing in the interior, and that was completely removed by the flood. And so since that time, our pasture management hasn't been as good as it was previous mm-hmm. to that. But when we work with the pigs, we try to use Temple Grandin's methods. And she was a lady who thought like an animal. And so whenever we want to move the pigs or load them into a trailer or, you know, make them do something they wouldn't naturally perhaps be inclined to do, you have to kind of think like a pig. And that has seemed to work very well for us. And it keeps it managing them from being like a rodeo and more like a rambling walk and a picnic.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things Temple Grandin says is that pigs have a balance point, which is roughly by their front shoulders. And
right.
So once you understand that balance point, you can pretty much control them just by where you stand. Jack?
Yes. There's so many different factors that play into that. For us, what we try to do is motivate them by, they love to walk. If there's an alleyway, a conventional alleyway would have a sharp 90 degree turn and straight edges. And so what we do is we have a sweeping alleyway, so that
by alleyway you mean a movement, a place to move them, right?
Right. When we load them up to go to freezer camp, we have a pen that they go into to eat, and then we close off that pen and we'll sort out the size that we want to take. And so in that alleyway, the outer wall that looks out to the rest of the pastures is blocked off so they can't see. But they can see through the inner wall. So when there's one pig getting ready to go into the trailer and the other pig is 50 feet away, he looks over and he sees his buddy walking into the trailer. So he wants to walk that way. And because there's no sharp angles, they just sort of make that sweep and walk through. And so it doesn't take a lot of cajoling to get them into the to where the food's at. And we always feed them in the trailer, so they go in, you know, anticipating treats. If it always worked nice like that, that would be great. But every once in a while, you get a stubborn sow that goes, hey, I'm not going in there, you know, I'm turning sure. around. And so...
And they are temperamental like that, too, aren't they? Pigs are kind of notorious for going along, and then all of a sudden, I'm not going along with that.
That's right. So,
I've heard that when you frighten them, they'll bunch up and won't move at all. Have you ever experienced that?
If they get frightened, they normally will, in our case, they will run because they have... property. They have a way of escaping. So I guess if they were confined, they would probably bunch up. But for ours, and that's one thing we like about the idea of being open, because if a threat does come in, they can run and
escape.
They can
run for it. Yeah.
Now if someone starts harassing a piglet and that piglet squeals, you won't just have the mom coming after you. You'll have the aunts, uncles, and everybody else. They are very community, and they will come running to whatever's threatening that piglet. And so you really have to be careful for that, because you'll never outrun an upset pig.
Yeah. Now, given that behavior, is it hard for you to understand how pigs have taken over California in the wild?
Oh, in the wild. I thought you were talking about Sacramento.
Same.
Yeah,
true.
No, pigs are very adaptable. I think if I've talked with people that have had, you know, catastrophic events like flooding, and the pigs have gotten out, and they'll find those pigs, you know, 5 years later, created their own little colony and herd and all that stuff, because they're very adaptable. So even without a daily, you know, someone bringing them food every day, I think they will find food if it's out there to be found. And
And they have so many ways of acquiring food. They can dig it out of the ground. They can pull it off a tree. Anything that they can reach, they can eat. And they're not picky. They definitely do have their preferences. They absolutely love chocolate. And they're pretty fond of alcohol, too. But,
just like people, aren't they?
People.
Just
yes,
like people.
Yes.
Well, folks, we're going to take a quick break. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Jack and Sarah Kimmick. California Kurabuta, pasture-raised pork. Different way of raising pork, but to me, a much more appetizing way. We will be right back. Well, we are back. This is Food Chain Radio Program, where today we're talking about delicious pork from pigs that have been raised on pasture rather than in a confined animal, concentrated animal feeding operation, getting a lot some of the most important food for a pig is the vitamin C they get from rolling in the dirt outside in the sunshine. Sarah?
Yeah, there are a lot of advantages to them being able to be in contact with dirt. It helps keep their gut bacteria healthy.
Uh-huh.
And that's something that's not even part of the equation for a CAFO-raised animal. And the fact that our pigs now are, and for many years, have not been fed conventional animal foods. We are careful to keep any corn and soy out of their diet.
Why is that?
So those foods are actually not easy for them to digest and aren't really good for them. I mean, because they're survivors, they can survive on it. But what they are fed, you know, kind of with the seasons, is so much better for them. We're in the middle of a walnut growing county, and so what they do is they harvest in the fall and put all the nuts in cold storage, and every month they process. So the net result is our pigs get walnuts about 8 months out of the year.
And rich in good fats. Oh, yeah. Good food. You know, we talk a lot about food waste, but you seem to have figured out a way of reducing a lot of that waste by...
Well, that's true. However, due to the new food safety laws, that has been changing for us.
Ah.
We're finding that, you know, we spent 10 years developing networks so people would call us and say, hey, we had someone call us and say, I have 1 million pounds of frozen pasta we need to get rid of. And so we have networks with other producers, not just pigs, but cattle and whatnot, so that we can, you know, spread that stuff out so it never goes into the landfill and doesn't get composted, because compost is a great use for it. However, feeding animals that feed people is a higher value. So what we found in the past 2 or 3 months, we've had companies that normally would process the stuff, or, you know, let us take it, and sometimes even pay us to take it, have now had to come to the point and said, you know, with all the regulations, in order to do this, I have to hire another, you know, part of the agency. They have to hire more people. And so we're just going to have to throw it in a landfill. And that was very disheartening for us, because the ultimate goal is to upcycle stuff and not put it in a landfill. But due to regulations, they said that they've already had, you know, one place, they said, we've been audited 3 times in the last quarter, and they keep saying, what are you guys doing with this stuff? Where is it going? And a lot of the farmers, you know, they used to be able to field spread, you know, vegetable culls for cattle. Well, now the new rules say that it can be on the ground for 24 hours and it has to be disked in, because they're afraid of rodents coming out and eating and causing all this problem. But, you know, 24 hours, now you're disking that into the soil. That's breaking up the soil, which is not what we want to do. And for us, when we put 10 tons of broccoli on the ground, the pigs go through and eat it. And what they don't eat in a couple days, I'll scoop up and I'll put into the compost pile. As it breaks down and decomposes, then we have the pigs go in and they'll root around in that compost, and they'll eat the white wood rot fungus that grows in there. It's a string fungus. It's very beneficial.
And pigs love the fungus, don't they?
They love truffle. Yes, yeah.
So absolutely.
It's great for their body health. When we talk with the people that process our pigs, the people that are, you know, cleaning them and dressing them and everything, they said, we can't believe your carcasses. He says, it is amazing. And he said, it doesn't have the smell that the other places do. And I said, what do you mean smell? And they said, well, sort of like, you know, used pig food smell. And I said, well, that's good news, because we don't want our pigs smelling like used pig food. So, but that's part of the whole cycle. Now we're also dealing with California EPA and dealing with all these new emissions on trucks. I have a truck that gets very low mileage, you know, under 10,000 miles a year, and we have to get rid of that truck, and I have to spend $160,000 to replace it to keep into regulations in California.
You know, I've watching agriculture for 1,200 food chain radio programs, I've come to the conclusion that a good 80 to 90% of regulations are designed to keep family farmers out of business.
Oh, exactly.
It feels that way.
It really
does. If you were to step back and look at all of the regulations that are out there, you know, the really big farms, it's not a big issue for them, because they're selling thousands and thousands of pounds of product, versus the smaller farmer, there's no way. Where those other places, they can take 10 cents out of a 10 cents a pound out of meat and cover their expenses, where for us, it's impossible.
Well,
the economy of scale is quite different.
Economies of scale. It's all, if you have the economies of scale, you can go to government and buy government and have them institute rules and regulations that only you, who have the economies of scale, can afford. And then you get rid of all your competitors. And so that's pretty much all small farmers have to face up to. And to me, there's one way of competing with that advantage of economies of scale, and that is the food that you produce. And getting the word out that cheap food that they produce really isn't all that cheap at all.
You know, Michael, I quote you on that often. Cheap food isn't.
Cheap food isn't, yeah.
You know, our job as small farmers partly is to convince people that they need to eat real food, and it's not going to be as cheap as a large grocery chain store. It's a different product altogether.
Yeah, and to compare the two, it's ridiculous to even compare the two kinds of pork. I read this really interesting comparison that what was the price of a pasture raised pork, $15 a pound or something like that, whereas a price of a factory raised pork is $3.50 a pound. So it's like four times more to buy pasture raised pork. And then, but what if you take that pasture raised pork and divide it into $4 for a quarter pound, and then compare that quarter pound with a quarter pound Big Mac that would be cheap food. Mm-hmm. Your quarter pound pork that was raised on pasture with great food would be the equivalent of buying a Big Mac that came from a CAFO. Expensive pasture raised pork, it's really quite a good deal because you're getting real good food. Whereas with the quarter pounder from the drive-thru, you're getting cheap food.
I think people have to come to that decision about what they're going to put into their bodies and how important that is to them. And we're kind of riding that wave because the pasture-raised pork is more expensive. There's just no way for it not to be. And people have to decide if they want to eat real food. And I think it's a false economy because you may save money on your grocery bill. But Jack and I decided long ago we'd rather pay more for food and less for doctors.
And that's the whole principle. But you still have to contend in the marketplace with that idea. You still have to stand up and fight for it. Because those who own the CAFOs are certainly standing up and fighting for their way of doing things. You know, they have the, like we said, they have the economies of scale to go out and, you know, buy a government and pass rules and regulations that only they can contend with. You have to figure out, small farmers have to figure out how to stand up and contend with that in the public sphere. And I see it happening. I see people standing and looking at the food and wondering where it came from and who grew it and how they grew it and what's in it. Because that's really where the value and the true value of food is knowing those things.
Michael, one of your laws of food is know your farmer.
Yeah.
And we're constantly telling people, know where you buy pork off of the Bacon Bus or through the CK Meat Club. You buy that pork, you're able to talk with us. We don't do farm tours due to the fact that because we don't use antibiotics and medications and vaccines on our pigs, we have to have a very tight biosecurity so they don't get sick. You know, we tell everybody exactly how we do this stuff so they know they're buying pork that doesn't have corn or soy. With corn and soy, as soon as you feed corn or soy to an animal, the omega-6s increase and the omega-3s decrease. Well, omega-6s, they last a long time. They have a long shelf life. That's why all the box foods are loaded with omega-6s. But omega-3s is what our body needs to keep the veins slippery so plaque doesn't stick to it. And it allows our body to process things and filter and like it was designed to. That's one reason why we feed our pigs corn and soy, or don't feed them corn or soy. Because we want those omega-3s high. We want them to be healthy. I have people that raise, 500-600 pigs at a time, and they're telling me, oh my gosh, dude, what do you do for this? And I'm going, well, we never experienced that. And they just can't believe it. Well, these guys are out roaming around. Every once in a while, minerals are so important. And people, they don't understand it. But one day, all of a sudden, I'm running around, and I'm noticing I've got a lot of pigs that are limping. And so I go up to them and I'm feeling their ankles and they're swollen. Their ankles are totally swollen. And so I go back to the Pearson Square. It's a chart for developing different rations. So when you make an alternative ration, you got to make sure you have different things in there so the pigs are getting exactly what they need. And so I found I was deficient in the mineral. So we got the mineral input. And within a week, all the pigs are walking around and there was peace in the herd again. You make sure they have the minerals that they need, and then the swelling goes down and they're happy pigs. And we have to watch that more because we don't have a blended bagged feed that we feed them. And so we have to be really careful and make sure that they get a well-rounded diet.
And, you know, if you think about the CAFOs, that where you have 100,000 pigs a year in this pig factory, you have a pig economist there who's probably measuring every single food ration to make sure that there's absolute minimum requirements there, but no more than the minimum requirements.
Right.
So the pigs, and they probably pay this chemist, you know, thousands of dollars a week just to make sure that they don't overfeed the pigs because the feed is expensive.
It's all money.
Yeah,
that's
so right. It's all money. So you're feeding absolute bare minimum to these pigs in the feedlot, and then you have to feed them the antibiotics to keep infections down because they're in this incredibly infectious environment and can't move at all.
It's toxic, yeah.
And your pigs are just running free. Do they get sick? Do they get infections? How do you treat them?
It's very interesting because every once in a while, like we had a sow that she got really, well, she wasn't a sow, she was a gilt. She got really sick, not sure what happened, called in the vet. The vet lifted her up and about a half cup of milk came out of one nostril. Said, well, while she was drinking out of the trough, she obviously, you know, inhaled and snuffed up a bunch of milk in her lung. So we nursed her, and, you know, her name was Tostito, and she became one of our best nursing mother sows. If there was a piglet from another litter that, you know, was an odd man out, we would take her to Tostito, and she would nurse those pigs up. She died at a very nice old age of natural causes. A lot of times we can look at a pig and we could say, hey, you know, big guy isn't moving around so much. And you find out because they're walking along, they step over trees and stuff like that. If they, you know, twist an ankle or something like that, they favor it for a little bit. And you can look at it and see what needs to be done. And most of the time they relax, they stay by the lake. And we really haven't had all the problems that a lot of these, I talk to these other guys and they go, oh my gosh, we had, you know, 60 pigs get the shakes. And I says, what the heck is the shakes? And I says, well, it's some meningitis type thing. And they're like, oh gosh, you know, so our biggest concern is when we drive our truck off the property and we go to process, because where we process, there's trucks from Montana, from all over the United States go in there. And we, you know, I bleach my shoes,
oh,
I bleach
boy.
Inside of the truck, everything sanitized, because I don't want to bring
what they have,
you know,
to your farm.
Back.
Well, folks, right. We're running out of time, doggone it, because this is such good, interesting stuff. Pasture-raised pork. California Kurobutu pasture-raised pork. Jack and Sarah Kimmick, thank you so much for joining us today on The Food Chain. And we want to encourage all you folks out there to remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, which is cheap food isn't. Thank you, Jack. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Michael.
Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain radio show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.